That's what I've heard.
I'd like to call to order the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. Today is Thursday, January 22nd. Please excuse the delay in starting this morning. This afternoon we did have some technical difficulties with the sound, and I believe it's working now. Thank you for your patience. I would also like to remind everyone that because of difficulties with the sound system in these rooms, I would like to ask you to actually turn off your cell phones, BlackBerries, PDAs. I know it's very difficult to do that, but please turn them off because they do interfere with the sound system. At this time, I'll open an informational meeting. An overview of consumer protection jurisdictional and enforcement issues. And as we move forward in the session on this committee, it will be very helpful for all of us to understand who does what in terms of enforcing our laws. And I've invited here today some experts in enforcement issues to explain jurisdictional issues and enforcement issues in consumer protection law in Oregon, and we can keep these things in mind as we begin to consider bills. Sometimes people ask, do we need new legislation? Do we need better enforcement of existing legislation? And this session that we're having this afternoon should help us in answering those questions as we start to consider bills, which we will be doing soon. First, I'd like to invite the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Corey Streisinger, to come forward. And are you bringing Teresa Miller and David Tatman with you?
David Tatman to join me.
Terrific. Well, we have three chairs, so welcome. And I know you've done this many times, but please introduce yourself for the record. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm pleased to be here. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here at the beginning of this session with you. With me here is David Tatman, who is Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and Teresa Miller, who is Acting Administrator of our Insurance Division. And we have been asked to give the committee an overview of our jurisdiction and enforcement in the area of consumer protection. I'd like to make a few introductory comments, and then I'm going to turn it over to Teresa and David to talk about the specifics of their program areas. As an agency, as I think you know, our scope is pretty broad, and our major programs include Oregon OSHA, workers' compensation, building codes, and the financially related programs that we're going to talk about today. And we have provided you with a packet that includes some background information about the entire department. We do enforcement actually throughout the department, but I do want to note that as a regulatory agency, enforcement is only one of our tools. We have a toolbox that includes in pretty much all of our program areas whether we set standards through rulemaking, we determine whether entities meet standards that are required to do business in Oregon through licensure. We do examinations and inspections where we look at a company's business practices and financial practices. We do a lot of education and outreach, and that can be education and outreach to the regulated community about what they need to do to comply, and then, of course, education and outreach to consumers about how to make good choices and understand their financial products. And we've included some of our consumer outreach materials in your packet as well, just as an example. And those tools actually then also interplay with our enforcement tools, and you'll be hearing more about that from both Teresa and David. We are a regulatory and consumer protection agency. Our jurisdiction is fairly broad, but in some ways it's also fairly specific. In Oregon OSHA and workers' compensation, we touch every employer in the state. But in the program areas that we're going to talk about today, our regulatory scope is limited to some specific areas and industries that are assigned to us by statute, primarily insurance, lending, securities, and similar financial programs. Although our name is the Department of Consumer and Business Services, there are many consumer protection issues that don't fall within our scope of responsibilities, and I know you'll be hearing from the Department of Justice also this afternoon about the scope of what they do. And so one question that often comes up, and I think Chair Bonamici alluded to this, is, so who does what, and why are certain programs placed at the Department of Consumer and Business Services as opposed to the Department of Justice or elsewhere in state government? And I will tell you, there is no hard and fast answer, and one of the things we need to do when we deal with consumers and the public is make sure that whoever they call, they actually get to the right place. So one of the things we do is try not to say, that's not us, but rather, let me get you right in touch with the person who can help you. But nevertheless, it is always a challenge for a consumer to know which number to call. As I say, we try to make that as seamless as possible. And sometimes, although sometimes it's an easy call, the major financial regulatory programs are with us, sometimes it's simply for a new program, a question of a legislative choice about which agency's skill set best matches the need of a program. And I want to give you two actually very recent examples which are probably familiar to all of you, and both of which involved a question of whether the program enforcement should end up at DCBS or DOJ. The first example is from 2007. We were just talking about this. Senate Bill 583, the Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act, something that's of great personal interest to a number of members of the committee, I understand. and you did hear a report from our agency last week about some of the ongoing issues. And that bill, it requires all Oregon businesses to meet new standards for the protection of personally identifiable information that could be used for identity theft. So there was a lot of discussion about, well, how should that be enforced? One of the goals of the bill was to do intensive outreach to businesses about what they needed to do to comply, to actually protect consumers. And that is something DCBS does on a regular basis. So the bill assigned enforcement responsibility for that new piece of legislation to DCBS, even though both agencies are very concerned about issues of ID theft. Second example, from the February 2008 session, the legislature passed House Bill 3630 to crack down on foreclosure rescue schemes. And these are people who hold themselves out as being able to save you from foreclosure. It's a considerable problem, particularly in this economic climate. And there was, again, a lot of discussion about what are the right enforcement tools for that bill. And those who worked on the bill concluded that the right tools were civil enforcement, both through private rights of action, but also enforcement through DOJ's powers. Again, both agencies were actively involved in that issue. So some of these are simply a question of, well, what seems best when we're looking at what the problem is that we're trying to solve. And there are also some areas where responsibility is divided. For example, although we have primary responsibility over securities enforcement, we supported DOJ's proposal last session to give them a lead role in securities actions involving nationally traded securities traded on the national stock exchanges, because their work with their national counterparts, we agreed, put them in the best position to handle what are often multi-state cases. One final jurisdictional element I want to touch on before handing it over to Teresa and David to talk about enforcement is the relationship between state and federal regulation. Insurance is almost entirely state regulated. There is no federal oversight agency for insurance, unlike other major financial products. And insurance insurance regulation at the state level has been, I think, very effective in ensuring solvency. Some of the big solvency issues we've been hearing about at the national level, AIG, for example, the company that had the solvency problem was the non-insurance regulated federal holding company. The state regulated insurance subsidiaries did not have solvency problems. But insurance is a national industry, and we work very closely with insurance regulators in other states. And again, Teresa is going to talk about that. Some of our other financial programs, the picture is different, and we share regulatory responsibility in various ways with the federal government. For example, securities are regulated at both the state and federal level. Banks and credit unions can choose whether to be chartered by the federal government or by state government, and that does sometimes present complications for those of us interested in consumer protection, because state ability to regulate federally chartered banks and credit unions is quite limited. It is preempted in many respects. So that is an issue that tends to come up in these types of discussions. In those areas as well, we work very closely with our federal counterparts. So with that background, I'd like to turn it over to first Teresa, who's going to talk about insurance, and then David's going to talk about the other financial programs, and all of us will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And it's my intention to wait and ask questions of the entire panel when they finished. Is that all right, committee members? Any problem? Okay. All right, go ahead. Thank you.
Hi. Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, my name is Teresa Miller, and I'm currently the Acting Administrator for the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I'm pleased to be here today to talk to you a little bit about some of the enforcement tools that we use at the division. At the division, we have three primary sources from which the Insurance Division learns of potential violations of the insurance code. Primarily, we learn of these potential violations from consumer complaints. That's the majority of how these things come to us. We also get referrals from law enforcement and from other government entities, and we also do our own investigations and analyses where these things come up. As I mentioned, by far most of these things come in through the consumer complaint process. In 2008, the division received approximately 4,000 consumer complaints and 15,000 inquiries from consumers. And I have to say, I'm very proud of our consumer advocates. They do a great job. They're very effective in resolving complaints to the benefit of consumers. And in 2008 alone, our consumer advocates were able to recover nearly $2 million for the benefit of consumers. Once a consumer advocate receives a complaint, they forward that complaint along to the insurer or the agent and ask them for a response. And they're statutorily mandated to respond, which is one of the key tools, quite frankly, that's available to the division. Failure to of the insurer or the agent to respond can result and often does result in us taking enforcement action. Through consumer advocacy and through effective working relationships that we've developed with our stakeholders, our consumer advocates frequently receive very, very good results for consumers, even in circumstances where there's not a clear violation of the insurance code. And I want to give you an example of that. We had an insurer that, through a telephone solicitation, had sold two insurance policies to a woman with a disability who later regretted purchasing those policies. She contacted our division and asked us to intervene. We contacted, as we always do, the insurer, and as a result of that contact, the insurer canceled those policies and refunded the money to the consumer. In cases where it's very apparent that an agent or insurer has violated the code and the consumer advocate feels that it's necessary, they will forward those complaints to our market analysts and our investigators. And investigators typically handle violations committed by insurance agents, and our market analysts typically investigate and handle violations committed by insurers. Because agents are often licensed in multiple jurisdictions, our investigators will work with other jurisdictions around the countries, other regulators. They also monitor enforcement actions and administrative actions taken against agents throughout the country. And as with consumer complaints, agents and insurers are mandated and need to comply with our investigators. And again, if they don't, we often do take enforcement action. Violations of the insurance code committed by insurers are typically investigated by the division's market analysts. And our market analysts are really looking for patterns of activity, whether that's in the market as a whole or whether that's with a particular insurer. So, for example, if a market analyst determines that an insurer has failed to adequately pay claims for a mandated procedure, the division will request that the insurer reprocess and pay those claims as required by the code. Like investigators, market analysts also work with regulators in other jurisdictions, as well as our national association, which is the NAIC, or the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. When an insurer or an agent fails to comply with the division, as I mentioned before, as they're mandated to do, or if the severity of the complaint warrants it, the division does have a list of formal and informal enforcement tools at its disposal. And I just want to go through some of those briefly. One is we can assess civil penalties up to for an agent up to $1,000 and for an insurer up to $10,000. And I want to make it clear that those are per offense committed. So in a case, each act that violates the law can be a separate offense. So you could have a case where an insurer has failed to pay 10 claims. That would be potentially $10,000 per claim, so you could have a fine of $100,000 in a case like that. The division can also require insurance individuals or companies to pay as a civil penalty any profits that they've received as a result of failing or as a result of violating the code. The division can also issue cease and desist orders requiring the individual or company to terminate conduct in violation of the code. We can refuse to issue or renew a license or place an insurer on probation or suspend a license or revoke a license of an agent. And typically, the next bullet is really about and addresses financial impairment for the most part, but the division can also place an insurer under supervision, which allows the division to monitor the activities of the insurer. We can revoke an insurer's certificate of authority, or we can seek judicial authority to take further action to rehabilitate or liquidate an insurer. And again, those are in cases where we're concerned about the financial condition of the company and the ability for the company to pay claims. The division can also refer an agent or insurer to law enforcement or for criminal prosecution. And the last tool that I want to talk about is actually the most important tool, I think, or arguably, that the division has. And this is the ability to enter into stipulated orders. Though the division doesn't have the authority to order it, we can require insurers and agents to do things such as restitution for consumers, or we can regulate future conduct by getting a stipulated order on it. So again, we can go further than the law would necessarily require with the stipulation. And I just want to give you a brief example of sort of the power of the stipulation. We had a recent case involving Bankers Life and Casualty. After an extensive investigation by the division, we determined that Bankers had made several unsuitable annuity sales to seniors. So under the stipulated order that we signed with them, Bankers was required to change the way that they sell annuities. They were required to refund money to seniors where there was an unsuitable sale, and they were required to pay a fine of $150,000. So they were required to do many things as part of that order because they agreed to it that they wouldn't necessarily have had to do just under the law. That's what I have. I've appreciated the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the enforcement tools that we have at the division, and I'll be happy to answer questions at the end.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tatman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity to appear today. My name is David Tatman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. In the back of that packet that you received, we have what we call our stakeholders report, and that's for 2007. And rather than go through the lengthy litany of all the programs we have, let me just say that we have 16 different programs under our current program jurisdiction. And that is a lot for us to try and put together in the next 7 minutes. So rather than talk in great length, what we've done is put together a chart that outlines for the different programs the various tools that we have in terms of enforcement powers. And it's alphabetical, doesn't reflect anything if it's on the first page or the last page, just alphabetical, and it shows that there are some similarities. Before I get started in that, though, I just wanted to touch on something that the director mentioned that I think it's important to reiterate, and that is that our enforcement powers are not solely that of the investigation and the subpoena and the civil litigation and the criminal case. It also starts with the process that we use when we register or license somebody. And many of the companies we register and license, we require the individuals to get licensed. They have to meet minimum education requirements. They have to take testing. They have to go through a background check. So there's a screening process. A good example of where we do this is when we charter a new bank. When we charter a new bank, it is an extensive process because obviously it's a very significant role that a bank has in our society, taking people's money and holding it. And that process requires us to go through and do background checks on all management. We expect certain levels of experience. We expect the board of directors to meet certain levels of experience and be meet standards of expectation in the community, if you will. We also go through and say there are minimum capital requirements to make sure that the bank can survive for the lean years that a new bank is going to have. And then finally, if they're going to register the stock to sell it, to raise that capital, we go through and review the registration process. So we touch many prospects or many roles within the formulation or the formation of a bank. So that's kind of an overview of just getting your foot in the door to become a registered business. The next thing we do, and much of this will parallel, not too surprising, regulatory bodies will be very similar, will parallel what Ms. Miller said, and that is we have the ability to conduct examinations. And the examinations are a critical aspect because it's one thing to give someone a charter, but if you don't follow up and see how it's being used, it's hard to determine whether it's being properly conducted or not. Yes, we get a lot of consumer complaints, and that certainly triggers most of our investigations, but we also conduct examinations, and based on the findings of our examinations, that may lead to an investigation. One of the distinctions we try and make is someone who makes a mistake, who is either ignorant or is not aware of the situation, we want to use the examination to educate, to improve the process and make sure that those mistakes aren't repeated. Alternatively, though, people who engage in what people call malfeasance, bad acts, we're going to take that as somebody who's made a deliberate decision. We're going to use that as a basis to go to our enforcement process. There's more examples within the testimony, and I'm happy to follow that up, but in the effort to preserve time, I'd like to talk about our enforcement process itself. As you can see in the chart, we have a number of tools available to us. Most of our enforcement cases start similar to insurance through complaints from the public. We also get complaints from competitors. We get complaints from law enforcement. We get complaints from other state agencies. We get complaints from other states' agencies. And as I said, occasionally we will go through and do something proactive where we're engaged in gathering intelligence. And that may be going through the internet, looking for certain advertisements and the like. We've had discussions in the past where we have a lot of unlicensed and chartered individuals in debt settlement or potentially in payday lending, and we'll go through looking for those, and if we find someone, we'll address that as a potential violation and go that way. We also look through newspapers and yellow pages and alike. That was one of the ways we addressed the question about pawnbrokering in this state. A lot of people who are engaged in pawnbrokering even held themselves out as pawnbrokers, were not licensed as such, and that was a very successful campaign. We went from 35 to 65 licensed pawnbrokers in the past 18 months. So we feel like that was a case where we were able to do our own intelligence. Back to the issue at hand, though, of enforcement tools. Primarily, we conduct our investigations as you much would imagine. We have the ability to go in and check books and records of those companies that are licensed with us. We can either go to the site and check the books and records, or we can ask for production of those books and records at our office. Similarly, we have subpoena power, and that subpoena power is a very powerful tool, one that we're very mindful of, and we use that only as needed. Most of the time, we invite people to come in. As people are subpoenaed in, they're expected to come in with counsel. They're not required to, but much like any other legal proceeding, if someone asks for counsel, the process stops, and they obtain their counsel. But that process is used to bring people in for formal questioning, oftentimes to produce certain records so that we have a chance to review that. Many of our key cases that we look at in these areas would be in the securities area, securities fraud in particular, or investment fraud. We also look at mortgage lending activity in this manner, and more recently, some of our non-depository programs, NDP shorthand, which includes consumer finance and various aspects of non-depository funding. And so those are the three areas we probably will bring people in more formally. If we bring someone in and we determine through the course of our investigation that there is a merit in going forward with some type of enforcement procedure, we have three options available to us in most of our programs, and that is we have the administrative process, typically known as a cease and desist order, that essentially says through this administrative order you shall cease and desist, that is stop what you're doing that violates the law, and then secondly we will impose certain sanctions if we feel that's necessary to correct behavior or to ensure that they don't engage in further violative conduct. So as Ms. Miller pointed out, we can impose a civil monetary penalty, much like she has in her authority. We don't have, or much like she doesn't have, we don't have authority for restitution statutorily. That's why many of our cases settled administratively through consent. We call it a consent order. And in that case, they'll consent to the issuance of the order. And in most instances, if restitution is appropriate, we'll ask that they make restitution. If that's the case, then we will impose a civil penalty and suspend that condition upon paying the individual or the consumers that restitution. We feel that's a better use of our powers rather than seeking to get the civil money paid. It also provides an incentive for them to toe the line going forward. There are cases, though, where we don't feel like the administrative process is sufficient, and those are, we have the ability to pursue civil remedies, file a lawsuit, particularly in the mortgage lending and in the securities areas. And we use that sparingly, and we do that mostly when we think there's a need to try and take a company and put someone else in charge of that company, typically to wind it down. And we do that where we think there is a great deal of potential loss to investors or consumers, or we believe that the company is engaged in illegal conduct, typically a Ponzi scheme. I'm sure most of you have heard about Mr. Madoff, who's come to the attention of the public recently. That was the largest Ponzi scheme in history. But there are a lot of smaller Ponzi schemes that we will find out about, and we will file a lawsuit to take control of that and try and wind that down. And then lastly, if we're concerned that funds are going to either be absconded with or dissipated, we'll want to put someone in to wind down the business. That's a very time-consuming and expensive proposition, and most of the time we don't feel like it achieves much. We don't want to do that unless there is something to be preserved for the benefit of the consumer. We feel that most of the time an administrative action will give us the same results that we need in terms of the ability to stop bad practices or correct practices, obtain a financial penalty, and keep an eye or oversight of the individual going forward. Our last tool that we have is criminal prosecution, and it's one that we use mostly in the securities area, but also in the mortgage broker area. We have had a couple other criminal cases. The other exhibit that I've attached is a list of cases that we have. They're a sample of cases. We tried to pick cases that kind of run the gamut of all our programs and all the different types of enforcement tools we have. Each one with an asterisk next to it means it was a criminal case. Now, a criminal case is not, we don't have the authority to bring a criminal case. We're not charged as a prosecutor, but we have there are criminal charges or criminal sanctions within the various laws that we enforce. So oftentimes we may work with the FBI, we may work with the IRS or the United States Postal Inspector Services at a federal level, or we may work with local law enforcement, whether it's the City of Salem Police Department, City of Medford Police Department, or local sheriff's offices. And we will then make a referral to a district attorney's office or the U.S. Attorney's Office. In some cases, we have a legal staff, and we'll have one of our lawyers appointed to represent that prosecution's office. In other cases, we may bench it or provide assistance in those cases. Those are incredibly time-consuming because normally they are the biggest of the big. And the example you've got on the first page is the PAC Equities case out of Eugene, in which there was $20 million issued to various investors. And the length of time to put that case together was approximately 2-plus years. And we can't do every case as a criminal case, and it's not appropriate to do that. But when we do it, it sends a tremendous message to those who would be willing to engage in illegal conduct or intentionally defraud people. And so we try and use all those tools. They're tools available to us. I can go through these enforcement cases, but I think, again, in the interest of time, you've got that available to you. It shows that there are all kinds of different ways we use our civil and administrative powers, and there are all kinds of results that we get. The last thing I didn't touch on, and I think that's important to mention, is we do have the ability to take someone's license, and it's something that we use when all else fails, and we have taken licenses from people, particularly in the mortgage lending area, where we find that they just refuse to comply with the law and they choose not to bring themselves into compliance. Our goal is always to get compliance first, change the practice, allow these people to prove that they warrant getting a second chance, and if they fail, then we will take these more drastic steps. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. That was very helpful. I'm going to start with a question about restitution that both Ms. Miller and Mr. Tapman mentioned restitution in some cases. And obviously, you don't represent individual consumers, and it sounds like sometimes that's just an agreement with the company. But do you have some sort of test or threshold if you're going to seek restitution? Does it have to be a group of consumers that are affected, or might it just be one or two consumers? Is there some sort of in the public interest test that you look for before you bring that type of or seek that type of remedy?
maybe I can just give a general answer, and then if either of you want to chip in. Generally speaking, if the case is one that we are pursuing and we take enforcement action and there's been one consumer harm, we want to get that consumer helped. I mean, our first goal is to get that consumer made whole, and our second goal is to make sure that we correct that behavior. So we will always take the opportunity to get restitution for that individual. Now, there is obviously a screening process as to whether or not we see a violation that warrants enforcement action. But if we are taking action and we can get restitution, we will.
Thank you. Questions, committee? Anybody have any questions?
No.
Thank you very much. It's very helpful. Thank you. And next we have a couple of people from the Department of Justice. Keith Dabanovich is special counsel to the Attorney General, and Julie Annopoulos is the attorney in charge of consumer protection and financial fraud from the Department of Justice. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici and Senators. My name is Keith Dabanovich, and I am special counsel to the Attorney General. The Attorney General, as you probably have heard, places consumer protection very high on his priority list. Hence, that's why I'm here. He has tasked me with working with your committee and with the House committee and with Mr. Leonopoulos' group, and I look forward to doing that. By way of background, the Department of Justice is led by the Attorney General and is broken up into 8 divisions. One of the divisions is what's called the Civil Enforcement Division, and within that division is the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Section, which is led by Mr. Leonopoulos to my left. We are generally not a regulatory entity. Our primary focus is enforcement. The section is composed of 9 assistant attorneys general, 6 investigators, 5 enforcement officers, and 9 support staff. The unit, though, relies heavily upon volunteers, and Mr. Leonopoulos will explain that in detail, but primarily we have volunteers that answer the phone, and they are very helpful in screening calls and getting the inquiries to the right people. The section works closely with other states, and Mr. Leonopoulos will give you some examples, but in many cases, the consumer protection issues that we're facing here in Oregon are very similar to those, if not identical, to the states of Texas and Illinois and Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. So rather than us doing all of the work, we frequently work with those states to share resources and obtain a better result for the Oregonians. We also obviously work very closely with other state agencies, including the DCBS, and indeed on many, many occasions we work jointly with them. We utilize their expertise in many cases, and they rely upon us for some of our enforcement tools. Mr. Leonopoulos will provide more details about the section's activities, and we will be both very happy to answer your questions, and again, I look forward to working with this committee.
Thank you very much. Mr. Leonopoulos.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, thank you. I've provided you written copies of my testimony concerning the operation of this section. I'll give you a quick preview of what I want to cover and before going into more details, and then, of course, we'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Mr. Banovich has given a good overview of what the section does, so I'm going to start with describing our consumer complaint process and discuss some of our recent consumer complaint statistics, then discuss some of our prevention efforts briefly, spend more time on our enforcement efforts and how we enforce the state's primary consumer protection law, which is Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practice Act, or the UTPA. My written testimony concludes with some brief notes on funding and personnel of the section and some of the pre-session bills that we have filed for 2009. Our consumer complaint process, to begin with. we have a variety of ways of taking in consumer complaints. Many of them come into us electronically through our website. Many come in through regular mail. We have some walk-ins come into our office in South Salem. And our consumer protection telephone hotline, which is staffed by between 4 and 8 volunteers a day, fields many questions and directs consumers to appropriate agencies if we are not the the correct one for them. Telephone hotline volunteers also encourage people to file written inquiries or complaints with us if it sounds like the consumer has a bona fide consumer complaint or question that they would like addressed more formally than the volunteers can do over the phone. The first stop for a written contact or complaint that comes into our office is to one of our enforcement officers. Our enforcement officers are generally some of the more experienced people in our section. They have between the 5 or 6 of them, probably over 100 years of consumer protection expertise among them. They look to do two things. First, they attempt to resolve the consumer's complaint financially. They attempt to get a satisfactory resolution of the consumer's dollar complaint. They look to have the business make a refund to the consumer if that at all looks appropriate. Many businesses will do this when they're contacted by our enforcement officers. Many will not, but we typically obtain millions of dollars a year in consumer refunds for Oregonians. Last year, we obtained approximately $3 million in restitution. And anticipating Chair Bonamici's question, no, we don't have any threshold level for numbers of complaints that will trigger a request for restitution. One inquiry is sufficient. Quite often, we will not open a formal investigation with just one consumer inquiry or complaint on a company, but sometimes we do. Usually, what we're looking for when we open a formal investigation is a pattern and practice of an unlawful activity, as opposed to just a mistake that a business has engaged in. And that's the other thing that the enforcement officers really do. They screen the complaints and make sure that we're not just greasing the squeaky wheel and having businesses refund to consumers, only the consumers who complain, have them issue refunds, while the vast majority, as we know, of complaints may not ever reach our office. So we have our enforcement officers look to determine patterns and practices of unlawful conduct. And when we find that, that's the time when we are most likely to initiate a formal investigation. And a formal investigation essentially involves the matter being referred to an assistant attorney general, who's then teamed up with an investigator to make contact, formal contact with the company, usually through counsel, initiate either a settlement process or a lawsuit. And I will describe how that works through Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. In any event, at least once a week, myself, my chief investigator, and our consumer information coordinator, Jan Margosian, get together and review the cases for potential formal enforcement action through a regular case assignment procedure. Last year, our telephone hotline volunteers handled approximately 31,500 calls, the vast majority of which were from Oregonians. That was up from just over 31,000 calls in 2007. In 2008, we received over 12,600 written contacts, and we consider a written contact as a complaint in our data system. It comes in on a form that's labeled consumer complaint form, and sometimes the consumer complaint form just says something like, I might attach an advertisement or just describe a telephone contact and say, I thought you might want to know about this. It doesn't formally state a complaint, but it is given to us, again, typically on something called a complaint form. And it's, again, for our purposes, counted as a consumer complaint. So when you hear that number, that's what I'm talking about. That number, that 12,600, was up slightly from 2007. In 2007, we received approximately 11,100 written complaints. In 2008, we opened, so out of those 12,600 written complaints, we ended up opening 243 formal investigations through the case assignment process that I've just described. So as you can see, it's a very small fraction of the number of actual contacts or complaints that we receive that get opened into formal investigations. So who has been contacting us in 2008? It's about the same. Top five industries were about the were the same as in 2007. Telecommunications led the way. That's a very broad category on our complaint coding system that encompasses cable, satellite, cell phone, internet service providers, landlines. Financial institutions was next on our list. Many of those matters were referred over, not surprisingly, to DCBS because we code those complaints with categories like credit cards, mortgage brokers, commercial banks. Third on our list was international money transfers, Nigerian money scams typically. Next, collection agencies, followed by motor vehicle sales. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the prevention efforts that we engage in because I don't think that's what this committee's focus is, but I've described them briefly on page 3 of my written testimony, page 2 and 3. I would like to move now to a discussion of the primary consumer protection law in this state and the one that we enforce, and that's Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It's made up of a laundry list of more than 60 or so prohibited practices. It includes general prohibitions like causing likelihood of confusion or misunderstanding as to source, sponsorship, approval, or certification of real estate goods and services, as well as specific prohibitions such as the prohibition against manufacturing a mercury thermometer, for instance. Most provisions of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act are tied to real estate goods or services. And the definition of real estate goods or services are those which are or may be obtained primarily for personal, household, or family uses. Most consumer transactions, most of the time you go to the store, most of those transactions are covered under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. There are a few areas that are specifically excluded from the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. You've heard about some of those from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Loans and the extension of credit are excluded by a judicial interpretation of some of the terms in the UTPA. Insurance is specifically excluded under a provision of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Certain landlord-tenant issues are excluded. But again, the vast majority of consumer transactions conducted in the state fall under the jurisdiction of that law. In theory, district attorneys share enforcement authority of the Unlawful Trade Practice Act, but in reality, the last consumer protection DA program ended about 20 years ago. Since then, the Attorney General has been the sole government enforcer of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. One of the most useful tools that the Unlawful Trade Practice Act provides the state is the ability to issue civil investigative demands, to make an inquiry of a business when we have a concern that there is or may be a problem that is covered under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. We have the ability to have a business respond to a civil investigative demand and provide us answers to our inquiries, and if they don't do that in a timely manner, we can go into court, and we have gone into court, and actually enjoin the business from conducting any further business activity in the state until they comply with our investigative demand. So a business just doesn't have the option of ignoring our formal investigative requests. The legislature wisely gave the courts the ability, a very wide-ranging ability to make sure that, in fact, businesses comply with those requests so we can determine if, in fact, there is a problem that needs to be addressed. Some states have adopted as their consumer protection law model a sue first and ask questions later approach, and the Oregon legislature, I think quite wisely, some time ago, decided that that was not the proper approach to take for this state's consumer protection law. In fact, unless there is an immediate threat to public safety, welfare, or health, we are required to give a business a 10-day notice and an opportunity to resolve our concern with what's called an Assurance of Voluntary Compliance, or an AVC. That is a document that is signed by the business and filed with the court, and it actually addresses the concerns that the Department of Justice has and makes sure that the type of complaint that we are investigating, in fact, doesn't happen again. Many of our formal investigations end in assurances of voluntary compliance being filed with the court. Again, it's an effective way to get to yes on many of our investigations. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act does provide for a maximum civil penalty of up to $25,000 per violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and every sale of a product or every unlawful advertisement, for instance, would constitute a separate violation of the UTPA. So it doesn't take a lot of imagination to think of how that could multiply into a very large number. So the fact that there's potential high civil penalties, coupled with the fact that there is a real incentive both on the part of the department and on the business to settle a consumer protection-related investigation quickly, accounts for the fact that the vast majority of our formal investigations end up in settlements. Sometimes the settlements happen very quickly. Other times it may take years to achieve a settlement, and the lengthy cases are typically the cases that we end up working with our counterparts in other states in other states' consumer protection units in a coordinated fashion through the National Association of Attorneys General, or NAG. Yes, businesses like that acronym also. I'd like to just go through several recent examples of our enforcement actions, just to give you a flavor of kind of the scope of activity that we're typically involved in. Oregon has been recognized now for several years as a national leader in the area of pharmaceutical marketing fraud. We've taken many enforcement actions and settled and led many national enforcement actions against the largest multinational drug companies in the world, companies like Pfizer, Eli Lilly, and Merck, for deceptively marketing prescription drugs. Again, states like New York, California, and Illinois generally either leading or co-leading these multi-state cases in the pharmaceutical area with or for those states. Another example, we filed last year, we filed a lawsuit against LA Weight Loss for its misrepresentation about its weight loss programs and products. We obtained a judgment against Apothecure. Apothecure was a Texas pharmacy that was unlicensed to do business in Oregon and sold mislabeled prescription medication in the state that led to the death of two people in Oregon. We continue to negotiate settlements with retailers like Shell Oil Company, in their mini-mart gas stations, in their sales of tobacco products to minors. We negotiate with them agreements mandating that they adopt new procedures and contractual requirements to reduce sales of tobacco products to minors. We shut down scams like Tono Records. Tono is a California-based company that marketed free English lesson tapes and CDs to Hispanic consumers in Oregon, and then turned around and charged them hundreds of dollars in shipping and handling costs for these free tapes. We've filed many lawsuits and obtained judgments against unlicensed construction contractors. We ensure that automobile dealers comply with applicable advertising laws and regulations. Again, that's a flavor of some of the enforcement activities that we're engaged in. Again, the UTPA gives us wide latitude, really, if it's a transaction that affects a consumer, unless it's specifically carved out, it's probably something that we have jurisdiction over. Again, there, last page or so of my testimony, I've got some funding and personnel issues about the section and some of our proposed legislation that's been pre-session filed on consumer protection matters as well.
Terrific. Thank you very much. That was very thorough, extremely helpful. Under the when you bring the Unlawful Trade Practices Act actions, you said you can seek civil penalties for up to $25,000. And then as part of that process, is there a way to get restitution for consumers under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act actions?
Chair Bonamici, yes, indeed. The part of the potential remedies should we bring should we choose to bring a lawsuit, or should we have to bring a lawsuit, includes the ability for a court to order restitution. In fact, one of the when we send a notice, a 10-day notice to companies concerning the matter at hand, we by law have to offer them the opportunity to sign an assurance of voluntary compliance. And there are some only a few reasons that that we're given that we can decline that assurance of voluntary compliance. And one of the reasons, in fact, is that if the company has not made adequate provisions for refunds or restitution to consumers, if the assurance doesn't contain that provision, it's one that we can just decline out of hand. So, yes.
Thank you very much. Committee, any questions? Any questions, Senator Berger?
I've probably sent 25 or 30 Nigerian bank emails to your department, and I always kind of wondered what happened to them. Do you have any stories around that? I have a lot of really good friends in Nigeria.
Yes. Chairman Omiji, Senator Berger. We obviously get, I think we had over 800 Nigerian scam letters sent to us. We're inundated with them. The message, that's an easy message to send to consumers when they call and ask us about that. There are very few instances where consumers call when we tell people, absolutely, positively, you must stay away from this. It's a scam. Because most of the time they're calling about legitimate businesses. This is not one of those times, though. I will guarantee you that
I guess my question was, is there any way you've ever managed to find a successful enforcement strategy against these people since they are in Nigeria?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Berger, great question. As Mr. Leonopoulos said, I think the first thing that we try to do is prevent the scam from happening, and one of the best ways is education. But after the scam has already taken place, it's very difficult for us to enforce it because most of these people are in Nigeria, and our courts generally don't have jurisdiction or ability to grab a hold of somebody in Nigeria. So as a consequence, we've been working with the National Association of Attorneys General, NAG, and the U.S. Department of Justice in trying to go after these folks. And from time to time, we've been able to do so, and the Department of Justice is eager to chase after them as much as we are. But unfortunately, because of the jurisdictional limits of our courts, it's quite a challenge.
Thank you very much. And I know, Mr. Leonopoulos, you sort of skipped over the prevention part, and I want to assure you that it's important to all of us, too, because it's an important piece of what you do, and certainly it's important to our constituents as well to get that kind of education. So I appreciate that.
Absolutely, Chair Bromwich.
Any other questions? Senator Rosenbaum.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It would be a boring afternoon if we didn't ask more questions when people prepared so hard. So I had a couple, if that's okay.
Please, go ahead.
I wanted to ask, I think it was Keith, that you said that we worked a lot with four other states, Texas, Illinois, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania, which seemed like an odd assortment of states. Is that among other states, or are those the states that we're most similar to in terms of our laws?
Chair Bonamici and Senator Rosenbaum, I was just using those as examples. However, they happen to be some of the leaders of states that are willing to aggressively pursue, for example, antitrust violations, which we didn't get into, but we have worked with those states on some of the antitrust claims that we've brought. And they're also actively involved in pursuing claims on behalf of consumers in the pharmaceutical area. Not to exclude other states, but for either funding reasons or lack of interest, there are some states that are just not perceived of as being leaders in the consumer area, and they generally, therefore, are not participating in some of the joint efforts that we're working on.
And I did have a follow-up and then one more question.
Please,
so
go right ahead.
It would seem like Washington, since we share a border, would be an obvious state to cooperate with. So why is that not higher on your list?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, Washington does work with us from time to time, but not on every case. And just as California would seem to be a logical connection, it kind of depends upon the efforts of that particular state at the moment and whether they have any resources available. And unfortunately, every state, including California right now, has limited resources. So as a consequence, we're starting to see some states back away from some of the consumer activities.
And then my final question, Madam Chair, and I think your answer kind of leads to this. I'm sure one of the most frustrating things for people answering some of these complaints is to get a complaint about an area and not be able, even though it seems like something deceptive or unfair has happened, not to be able to do anything about it because there just are insufficient laws. And telecommunications, which is an area I know something about, always seems to be at the top of this list, although my guess is financial institutions may be creeping a little higher on that list. So it's not obviously on your legislative list of proposals, but is it possible for you at some point to have a discussion with us about areas where you think we could strengthen our laws? Do you see that as appropriately the role of the department? Because to me, I would think you're in a position to hear a lot of these complaints, as is DCBS, and to know what areas we actually... I mean, obviously, it's great to go after weight loss programs, and I'm sure it's painful to think you're going to lose weight and not do it, but certainly there are a lot of other things that we could be regulating, I think.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, if I may, I'll try and answer some of your questions, then Mr. Leonopoulos, I'm sure, will add in some points. In the telecommunications area, the PUC has some jurisdiction, so to the extent that there would be any regulatory or enforcement, it might be in their purview and not ours, unless it falls under the UTPA. We would be more than happy to have a discussion with you about how best to expand the UTPA to get into the areas where it is not presently applied, because I agree with you that there are some fields that and industries that should be covered by the UTPA that are not.
And Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum, we really relish the role of being the eyes and ears, if you will, of the legislature on consumer protection efforts. We welcome every opportunity to work with this committee, the House Consumer Committee, or any committee to look to improve consumer protection laws in Oregon. It's very near and dear to our hearts.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a great answer.
Thank you very much. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair. The question I have, you gave some figures about 30,000 plus complaints. Are these written out bona fide complaints, or are these just contacts, or what sort of things are those?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard. The 31,500 figure, those are calls, people calling in to our consumer complaint hotline asking about various things. We do not consider those complaints. Those are inquiries into our hotline. We have approximately 12,600 written contacts from consumers, the vast majority of which come to us on a form that has a 24-point bold type on the top, consumer complaint form. The only way a person gets that is by asking for a consumer complaint form to be sent to them, or by clicking on a link on our website that starts with file a consumer complaint and then download a consumer complaint form. If that consumer complaint form has on it something along the lines of just wanted you to know about this practice, FYI, yes, we count that as a consumer complaint.
And just a follow-up. So then what percent of the complaints, the bona fide complaints that are written on the form, are resolved, in a favorable way for the consumer?
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard. I don't have any statistics on that. I can tell you how many formal investigations we open as a result of the complaints, we currently just don't have a way. Our system doesn't count things in that manner. The matters are all resolved one way or another by either closing them as not enough information, by having them go on to a formal investigation, having them referred to another agency. So, you know, actually the real answer is 100% of the cases are resolved, but resolved means they are handled one way or another under our system.
Follow up. I just think that the breakdown of how that kind of plays out, how many are referred over to PUC, or how many are the complainant got what was completely happy with the outcome. It was determined that the plaintiff was not that was just not something that was legal, and the complaint was non-valid. Just so that you kind of have a breakdown of what the complaints are, I said on Ways and Means and other things, and what we're trying to do is find out layers of governments that are totally efficient. And so I kind of want something for you somewhere, and maybe not just on this committee, but to justify, you know, your agency and that sort of thing. So, you know, if you 12,000 complaints, that sounds like an awful lot, and I just want to see how it pans out.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Girard, we will look into that and try and get you more details on how each of these have been concluded one way or another, so that you'll have additional information on that.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you very much, and I know that we look forward to working with you as well. And I did want to mention to Senator Girard that Mr. Leonopoulos and I believe Mr. Dubanovich as well talked about how their calls are taken by volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
So that would, at least that one piece would not have a fiscal impact, right. But it would be useful to know.
Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
But the thing is, he said that the calls, that was under the 32,000, the 12,000 are the ones that actually fill out the
complaint.
Right.
Thank
you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, there's another piece of consumer law enforcement, and those are private actions that consumers bring. And to talk about that is Keith Carnes, who's been very patient in the back there. Keith, come on up. Keith is an attorney at Olson and Daines. I believe Keith is currently the chair of the consumer law section of the Oregon State Bar, and he has been a great participant in the mortgage lending work group and helped with the foreclosure rescue bill last February as well. So welcome.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici, for inviting me, and Senators, thank you. Actually, I'm chair-elect. I'll be chair next year, the consumer law section of the Oregon State Bar. And I work at Olson & Daines, a firm that does an ever-expanding amount of bankruptcy. And within that practice, I handle matters relating to debt collection, credit reporting, mortgage abuse, and the like. The issues, if I could just mention briefly, there are a couple issues that seem to me to be unregulated by the state of Oregon. It's my understanding that the debt collection industry is one that is only regulated to the extent that the state ensures, that DCBS ensures, that money that's collected by debt collectors is then passed on to the creditor who's owed the money. The state of Oregon, is my understanding, does not regulate the collection of the debt between the consumer and the debt collector. The Fair Debt Collection Practices Act was passed by Congress in the 1970s, and then there were findings made at the time that because there is no need to have an ongoing business relationship between the debt collector and the consumer, that there was a lot of abuse and harassment that led to bankruptcy, invasions of privacy, divorce, and the like. The Federal Trade Commission reports that every year their number one complaint is about debt collectors. And it's my understanding that debt collectors are not regulated in any sense in that way. The private bar is certainly limited as to what we can do against these debt collectors, especially since there's no bonding requirement for the debt collectors to which the consumer can seek relief. The only bond that is made is that DCBS or the original creditor can collect upon. However, every week, every month, I'm hearing complaints about people getting calls at work. I'm getting letters from bosses saying they keep calling me at home, asking my employee to pay his bills, and I'm going to fire him. I'm going to fire him if they don't stop. I hear people call with panic in their voices, thinking they're going to jail, because people are calling and saying, if you don't pay this bill, I'm going to send the police out. They'll lie, cheat, and steal to collect these bills. And I acknowledge, I'll be the first to admit, that this isn't every debt collector. However, we're seeing a vast proliferation of this as people fall into default and as people have a hard time paying their bills. The industry that also creates a lot of consternation are these debt settlement companies. We're seeing on the internet and on the television, I know the Federal Trade Commission is holding hearings to decide what to do with these folks who promise to settle up all your bills for pennies on the dollar if you'll just send them all your money. And I know that Chair Holvey has been concerned about that, and I understand he's proposing some legislation. But that is a grave concern to us, as well as these mortgage workout folks. It's my understanding, and I was on the committee that helped pass 3630, that 3630 involves only those people who are in foreclosure in default. There are a lot of people who have arms adjusting up on their homes who need help. HUD has approved housing counselors in the state of Oregon, and they do an excellent job, and they do it all for free. And they will go out and help people get their loans modified and get arms to fixed rates and things like that. But over and over again, I'm inundated. Every time I try and watch a baseball game or a football game, I see these constant ads proliferating in saying, for just a few thousand dollars, we may or may not do something that you can do, have a high-quality job done for free here in the state. And so those are certainly people who create a lot of concern for me. And I see these people coming in often who went to one of these debt settlement or mortgage workout companies, paid over all this money, and now they have nothing except for lawsuits and foreclosures and garnishments and other problems that they didn't have when the whole process started. On a civil enforcement side, there is one issue that perhaps is more perplexing than others, and that is the conversation that I have with my clients when they come in and explain their problem to me. For instance, there was one department store who had its own financing arm for a while before it sold it off to a national bank, who would repeatedly harass, call people at work, and just nonstop over and over again. And every time I'd need to tell a client that, you know, federal law just doesn't apply to this, but the state debt collection laws do. However, if we sue them and there's a failure of proof, or if we, you know, if there's some technicality on which the jury decides that we don't want you to prevail, you're going to be responsible for every penny of the other side's attorney fees. And that is a huge barrier to people seeking relief that they need. And I understand that there is some concern about people who bring malicious and unfair lawsuits on the plaintiff side. In fact, I've had, out of the hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits I've been involved in, I've had two clients break down and say, you're right, they didn't do anything wrong, I was just mad at them. And I find that despicable, and I do everything I can to make sure that doesn't happen with my resources. However, the federal law, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the like, allow attorney fees to be assessed to a plaintiff who brings an unsuccessful action if it's brought in bad faith or for purposes of harassment. I know that's how we've drafted 3630, and that seems to be an effective way to handle that. And so, as you move forward, I would hope that we can make sure that those who are taking advantage of the most vulnerable and the most poor have a bond that can be attached, and also that we allow a private right of action that would allow for the payment of attorney fees would be very helpful to consumers generally, especially now as we face, you know, these very hard financial times. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carnes. Any questions for Mr. Carnes?
Madam Chair, I was just wondering if you could turn your comments into written testimony. It looks like you might have had an outline or something. It would be really helpful to have.
Absolutely, Chair Bonamici. Sorry, Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum. I wasn't quite sure exactly what I was talking about today until I sat down at lunch and wrote out some notes, but I'd be happy to submit that to you maybe into next week.
That would be great.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Vice Chair George.
Thank you. You never admit that. I've done it a million times, but you never admit that you just did the notes. And I'm just thinking this question as we're going, so we're working together here. I actually, one of the things that I found was the most interesting about a lot of these discussions we're already having and during the interim, the work group, is there is this discussion of how many people get into these, and I'd like the agencies at some point to kind of discuss it too. So many people get into these ridiculous financial situations that you look at and you think, you shake your head, what were you thinking? And the Nigerian scam is one of those that you think, did you really think you're going to get $7 million for free? But nonetheless, that's something happens. There seems to be a breakdown someplace, in whether it's in our education system or whatever. And since you represent a lot of people who have these fraud situations, is there some way at the educational level, either in K through 12 education or something, that we need to bulk up financial planning at high school level so people understand a little bit more, not just about their rights as consumers, but their responsibilities as consumers, to sort of make sure that they're being aware? I'm constantly amazed how many people say, well, I just thought government was going to protect me, and so I could just kind of wander through. And it's like, well, there's Ponzi schemes and everything else going on. You got to be aware. How would you say, when you talk to your clients, we could actually come up with some diversion or some education, and where do you think that should happen?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Senator Bonamici and Senator George. I know that I grew up in Ohio, and I'm a product of the Ohio public school system, so I can blame it all on that. But I think that the issue is that my understanding, and my children are 5 and 3, so I don't know yet, but my understanding is we spend a lot of time in college and in high school talking about, gross domestic product and gross national product and these macro and fine, great things that economists need to know, but not so much how is it that you detect something that's too good to be true. How, when you sell something on eBay, do you know that you're not going to be, just giving your money and your stuff away? And we see that problem a lot as well, is that there's a lot of fraud going through eBay, Craigslist, all sorts of things like that. And the bankruptcy, the debtor-creditor section of the state bar and the bankruptcy courts have gone into the high schools and began a program of credit abuse resistance education. It's called the CARE program. And it's been recepted very well by the students and by the schools and the teachers. And my question is the same as, perhaps in civics or economics or some other class, we can have the students sit down and see these things, part of the curriculum in those classes. One of the reasons we know that it's not happening too much is because the credit card industry loves to solicit to recent college students, and the college students will buy this up. The recent statistics that I've seen are that those who are in trade schools and those who go to work out of school rather than go to college are far less likely to use credit cards because they know what it takes to pay it back. It's the people in high school and it's the people in college who just have part-time jobs and they're getting student loans and grants and living off of parents who they don't know what it means to earn $10 an hour and pay this money back. They're the ones who, are running up more credit cards and are more easily duped sometimes. And so I agree that, integrating that into the public schools would be a great idea and hopefully curb problems in the future.
Do you think that's a significant thing? I mean, is this something that, as we're in dealing with consumer affairs, do you really think education at the high school or college level is something that should be a state policy that we should pursue? Or, I mean, do you think that would defer? I mean, would you think that would intervene with some of your clients and make them maybe not make decisions or be sucked in by scams?
I would like to think so. I don't know. Having never studied the educational system except for, as a student and, going through law school and everything, I don't know the answer of how effective it can be. I do know that as I became an attorney and I started to see how the system works and I saw the pitfalls there are to fall in, and I hear these people's stories who are well-meaning but maybe empty-headed a little bit, that something's got to help. Anything's got to help. Whether, you know, they should, you know, whether the school district should spend less time talking about, you know, how a bill gets passed by Congress and more time on that, I don't know. I think it would help, and I think it could help. And I think that as people saw more of the nuts and bolts of the U.S. financial system, they may be less likely to go out and take out liar loans on mortgages. They may be less likely to just, you know, go take a payday loan or, you know, be less inclined to just, you know, spend as much as they can as quick as they can, because I think if they saw the other end of things, they would be less likely to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Carnes. I do want to point out that in the 2007 session, there was a task force created on personal finance and civics education that spent the interim studying those issues, and they have done a presentation on that. There was a financial literacy summit the week before session began, and there were some great ideas about how to get more personal finance education into our schools in Oregon. I know that at least, I know Representative Wisnett has already written to the Board of Education asking that they make personal finance one of the essential skills for the new graduation requirements. So there is a lot of discussion about that both in the education community and in the finance community. So people are aware of it. It's just adding another requirement to the K-12 curriculum is very difficult. Yes, go ahead.
One of the things that I think kind of amazed me, I was watching on CNBC the story about the Madoff scandal. They interviewed this stockbroker who had gotten her entire family to invest all of their money in the Madoff, and she had been a financial planner and stockbroker her entire life. And so here you have somebody who is at the highest level of financial savvy, you know, I mean, as high as you can get, and she told her family to invest everything because his returns were so great. And her response was, "Is that, well, I thought it was regulated." And I thought to myself, you know, it's a really interesting thought, because it's almost like when we build up a regulatory system that everybody thinks that everything's regulated, that people kind of click off their brains. And no matter how much regulation we pass, ultimately at the end of the day, you still got to be thinking with your own head, because if you're making 12% returns when nobody else is, you got to start asking yourself why. And so there's this balance of putting in more regulation, but then also telling people, hey, you know, wake up a little bit and look at things. And so there's always people out there to scam you. And I that's kind of was my observation. I'd like to see us look at it holistically.
Absolutely. And I know with some of the things, that the last story I read about one of the victims of the Nigerian-type scam, it was a senior citizen who probably just didn't have the savvy to be able to determine that that was a problem. Senator Gerard.
Madam Chair, I just lately I answered the phone, and I don't remember exactly the vice president. I remember Aaron Brewer was one. I think Lyndon Johnson was one. So the question comes out, which one of these is a vice president? Well, no matter how you answer, you'll be right. And they're usually obscure enough that the average person doesn't know. But then, and you are a big winner. You are going to win $500,000. But in order to get the winnings, you have to pay $10,000. To get the winnings delivered to you, and it's a big scam.
Did you collect the $10,000?
Yeah, no, I'm going to be filing the complaint, though, because not. But I think everyone in the course of their life will get one or two of these scams. And it's real frustrating. And you're right in the fact is that they play on people's lack of knowledge. And I don't know what to do about it.
Well, we'll keep working on it. Thank you very much, Mr. Carnes.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational meeting, and I just wanted to do a brief summary of what we're doing next week. I believe both agendas have been posted for Tuesday and Thursday. Tuesday, we'll have an informational hearing about foreclosure that talks about how foreclosure works, some of the structure, nuts and bolts of it, and then some of the consumer groups will be talking about some of the problems we've been having and rates of foreclosure and what's happening with those in Oregon. That will happen on Tuesday. I also plan to, at that time, elicit some information about how foreclosure is affecting tenants. And then on Thursday, we are hearing three bills that were sent to us from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So look forward to that, and thank you very much. And I will adjourn the meeting for today.